It's so wonderful to have the choir back. And our choir director said she could actually kind of hum along, so she has a voice again. Well, good morning. And welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society on this absolutely beautiful spring weekend. It's a perfect day to celebrate Earth Day. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background. Whatever your color, your sexual orientation, or your family structure, we welcome you. No matter what your age, your abilities, or your inabilities, we welcome you. Toward the end of the service today, we'll have an opportunity for guests or visiting friends or people we haven't seen for a while to introduce yourselves, and hopefully you'll feel comfortable at that time and tell us your name and what brought you here. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services, sometimes from someone who is a member of our congregation, sometimes from someone in the wider community, and sometimes our Reverend Ralph Tiksinski will present to us. And today, Ken Skog will be coordinating our service to celebrate and honor Earth Day. By the way, I didn't say I'm Rachel Long. I'm Prairie's current president. And our opening words today will be by Ralph Tiksinski.
These words were taken from our UUA statement of conscience that was passed in resolution form at the 2006 General Assembly. Earth is our home. We are part of this world, and its destiny is our own. Life on this planet will be gravely affected unless we embrace new practices, ethics, and values to guide our lives on a warming planet. We, as Unitarian Universalists, are called to join with others to halt practices that fuel global warming, climate change, to instigate sustainable alternatives, and to mitigate the impending effects of global warming, climate change, with just and ethical responses. Now, for our opening hymn, let us join together our hearts and voices, singing hymn number 203, All Creatures of the Earth and Sky. Stand as you are able.
Thank you.
Our chalice lighting this morning. We light this chalice for earth, our home. Earth abundant, source of what was before we were and will be after we are gone. Each day we must hold out the chalice of our being to help in creating a world in which all people are assured a secure and meaningful life that is ecologically responsible and sustainable. Now, let us enter into a moment of silence. Let us embrace the silence and meditation. As a caring community, we take time now to briefly share any special joy or concern, sorrow or a personal concern with our gathered community.
It's a joy that next Saturday night, the Madison Choral Arts Society, which has four Prairie members, will be having its spring concert. Dan Metcha, Paula, and Dean all sing in this choir, and it will be next Saturday night at 7:30 at Emmanuel Lutheran Church on Spate Street. So see a choir member if you would like more information. And it's also a joy to see Ann back today.
I have a joy. My youngest daughter, who lives in Arlington, Virginia, had a baby girl on Wednesday, and mother and daughter doing fine, and we're pretty excited.
I have a joy. As many of you know, my wife Rose had surgery on Friday morning at 7:30. The rest of Friday was kind of rough. But by the end of the day, she was doing very well. And by evening, she felt very chipper. And yesterday, that was even better. So she should be home sometime today.
Well, of course, it's nice to be able to actually talk into the microphone and sing a little bit. But we got a call from our son, Misha, who's in California and has done some sound editing for movies, to see if we had seen Bonneville, because it was it's at Westgate, one of the first movies that he worked on, and he actually is on the credits. So that's a real thrill. Of course, we haven't gotten there yet, but this week we'll go. But yes, it's.
One of the things that kept us busy was a joy on Friday night. An extra session of the Humanist Union had a national leader in the effort to keep creationism out of the science classroom, Dr. Eugenie Scott, and her friend John Powell, formerly of Public Radio, were our guests at our house for a potluck and an extended question and answer session, which is now available on the web if you want to hear what the program was about. Eugenie talked about her work in this area since 1980 and through the founding of the National Center for Science Education and its involvement with the Dover, Pennsylvania case, the PBS special on that case, and so on.
I don't know how many have seen it or whether it's been announced before, but in the April issue of Umojum magazine is a whole two-page spread about Margaret Carpenter. So, yeah.
Of interest to those who know my granddaughter Amberly, I came home late last night and found a very positive, uplifting letter, and she's slowly getting out of the ditch she was in. She's got an interesting 40-hour-a-week job, the first one of that type, working in some plant store, and it's really interesting. So things are getting better.
Okay.
She's in Milwaukee. Yeah, she still lives at her mother's house.
Besides a joy of being here with all of you today, I've been home for the weekend, and there are 14 pelican swimming around in the Ohara up by us. And many of them are breeding, so they have that extra hump on their bill. They're huge. Come on up and see them.
I guess mine's kind of opposite from Anne's, opposite from nature. What a joy it is for me to live now where families come by and we can watch them and little kids with their backpacks. And I came from the smart growth group in Coloma where our big objective was to make the lots big enough to where you would never see your neighbor.
We're happy to be back from our trip south, and after spending three continuous days getting here in the car from Florida, it was a joy to be bicycling out here this morning and finding six other bicycles and two trailers, which seven plus, well, one of them could take three. That'll get us up to 10 people, and my sorrow is there are so many others of you here without bicycles.
And I walked.
It was a joy last weekend when I wasn't here, but I was in Merrimack at Devil's Head Lodge to see just dozens of young Democrats at the Democratic Leadership Institute, I guess they call it. And the enthusiasm that they showed gives me some hope.
Well, I was singing in the choir when all those bicyclists were coming up the walk, and it was interesting to see, you know, one, and then another, and then another, and then another.
Okay, thank you. Today we are focusing our attention on this Earth Day Sunday on a topic that has been part of our speaker's life professionally and personally, I know much longer than professionally, but we have in our membership Ken Skog, and I'm not going to do a lot, we all know who Ken is, but just to remind some of the people who are perhaps new or visiting. Ken hails from Marquette, Michigan. He received his bachelor's and master's and doctoral degree from Michigan State University in East Lansing. His position today is with the United States Department of Agriculture, the Forest Service Products Lab that's here in Madison. But most important, Ken has been working and is a part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And that's the organization that shared the Nobel Prize with Al Gore this last year. And some of us are still holding that in our pride cap, knowing someone with that kind of connection. But that Intergovernmental Panel has been an effort to educate the public on the effects of climate change, and that's what Ken is going to continue to elaborate on for us today. So we're really pleased to have Ken Skog do his presentation. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. I wasn't expecting that. Well, I hope today to give, it'll be a fair amount of technical content, but I hope the overall message is one of hope that we can deal with climate change in the long run. In the long run here, I'm talking 50, 100 years. And I'm going to be talking about some of the details about how we collectively and individually can do that. I'll begin with, well, first of all, I should say I'll be drawing a lot of what I say from some talks that I heard at a conference this last January. It was one sponsored by the National Council for Energy and the Environment. And this last year, they have annual conferences focused on different environmental issues. And this year, their focus was on climate change science and solutions. So I'll be drawing a lot of what I say from some of the speakers from that conference. I'll begin by quoting two different sources. One is from one of the people that spoke, gave essentially the keynote speech for this conference. His name is John Holdren. He's a professor of environmental policy and earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. He says, "The world is already experiencing dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system," anthropogenic meaning human-caused. "The question now is whether or not we can avoid catastrophic interference." That's the downside. On the upside, I'd like to quote from a paper by two scientists from Princeton, Stefan Pakala and Robert Sokolow. And they've here's a quote from their paper. "Humanity already possesses the fundamental scientific, technical, and industrial know-how to solve the carbon and climate problem for the next half century." And I'll explain exactly how they think we can do that as I go on. Now, backing up, I'll talk about four different things in my remarks today. First of all, what is it that we need to do to avoid catastrophe? And particularly, what does the United States need to do? That's number one. Second, I'll shift from the kind of a U.S. focus to a global focus. What do we need to do at the world level to avoid these impacts? Third, I'll shift dramatically from the world level to the local level. And I'll be quoting one of the other speakers at this conference, who has some ideas about what each person can do to decrease emissions, some simple, easy, high-impact changes in behavior. And then finally, how can Prairie act as a community to mitigate climate change? So I'll begin. The first point is about what does our target need to be, particularly what does the United States need to do? And I'll draw on a talk by a representative of the Union of Concerned Scientists that I heard at this conference, and the title of their talk was "How to Avoid Dangerous Climate Change." Now, it turns out this word "dangerous" is important in legally, internationally, because the U.S. is already currently legally bound under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change of 1992. All the parties to that treaty are committed to stabilization of greenhouse gas concentrations at a level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. The United States is already legally committed to that convention. And that's the vehicle by which all countries are now meeting periodically to discuss and deal with the climate change question. In fact, this last week in Paris, they had a first round of discussions after the Bali conference to come up with a successor treaty or successor agreement to the Kyoto Protocol, which expires in 2012. So this framework convention is the underpinning of all of these activities. Well, going on, so that's our legal commitment under the UN Framework Convention. The person from Union of Concerned Scientists was synthesizing and then doing some analysis of the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And this is the result. We need to stop our global warming at 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. That's 2 degrees centigrade. If we go to 2.5 degrees above or 3 degrees above, there's a very high chance, almost a certainty, that we'll have really catastrophic consequences. In particular, very substantial melting of the Greenland and Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet, which could raise ocean levels substantially and cause considerable flooding along coastal areas. And one of the countries at highest risk of flooding and displacement is Bangladesh, I understand. So far, we've raised the atmospheric temperature about 0.8 degrees. And because the ocean is absorbing heat, that will, and the ocean will eventually release this heat, even if we were to stop all emissions today, we'll still go up to 1.4 degrees above pre-industrial temperature levels. So we want to stop at 2 degrees. In order to do that, in order to have a 50-50 chance of doing that, we need to stabilize carbon levels at 450 parts per million. We're currently at 385. And there's some people now that's saying we need to stop, we need to actually go back to 350. But my discussion is just going to say, all right, what do we need to do just to hit this 450 parts per million target? And the person from Union Concerned Scientists went on to say, well, if we agree to this target, 450 parts per million by the year 2050, and we stabilize at that point, we have a certain carbon budget between now and then that the entire world can emit. And if we, and it certainly seems like we're going to be pushed to allow developing countries to continue to increase their emissions for a period of time. So if we allow them to continue increasing their emissions to the year 2025, but the developed countries commit to turn their emissions around and start declining by 2010, then this budget, the way this budget looks is that we have, the developed countries have about 40% of this budget, and of that 40%, the U.S. would have about a third of that 40%. Now, in order to reach this target, this target only having that much of the world's emissions by the year 2050, the U.S. needs to commit to reducing emissions to 80% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. That's a huge undertaking. But the Union of Concerned Scientists and others, many other environmental groups, have very high praise for many of the pieces of legislation that have been introduced in Congress. There are, the legislators get it. There are pieces of legislation that are that aggressive. One of them that's already been reported out of committee is the Lieberman-Warner bill called the Climate Security Act, which would get close to that 80% target. It wouldn't get us all the way there, but it would get us close. But it has voluntary measures will be nowhere sufficient. I mean, we could put all kinds of money into technology development, but without aggressive controls, there's no way we could meet a target of 80% reduction. So we need either a cap and trade system or a carbon tax, cap and trade on, in other words, we cap carbon emissions and then we grant or auction credits at a decreasing rate between now and 2050, or we put a tax. It seems politically that a tax isn't going to work. That's my understanding currently. So the Lieberman-Warner bill, a number of other bills, have provisions for a cap and trade system. In addition, as part of the cap and trade system, they have varying levels of auctions. In other words, people would have to buy the right to emit carbon. And Lieberman-Warner bill starts out at a low proportion of the credits being auctioned and goes up to a much higher level of the credits being auctioned. And then all of this money that comes in, all this auction money that comes in, would go into subsidizing efficiency improvements, technology, and equally important, offsetting the economic difficulties it's going to cause for lower income folks, because energy will be more expensive under this higher carbon tax. Energy prices will go up, so we need supports for those who have a tough time paying those costs. So that's the nature of what the U.S., the target for the United States, and what the agenda before us. And there were two interesting things to relate about, more than two, but two interesting points at the talk that were that there was one of the prominent speakers was an evangelical minister who was very much there to voice the concern and the support of at least some significant segment of the evangelical movement for the aggressive climate mitigation measures. And he related a story about John McCain. He said that when John McCain was campaigning, and I think it was in South Carolina, he was asked how he would appeal to the evangelicals for their support, and his response was based on his aggressive stance on climate change policy. So there's a sense that there's significant bipartisan support for aggressive action. Now, I will shift from that kind of picture for the U.S. and where the U.S. needs to go in the next 50 years to kind of a global picture. And this will be somewhat more general, but it'll give some sense as to the magnitudes of the changes that we need may need to make at the global level. And the actions we need to take at the global level are taken from a study done by Stephen Pakala and Robert Sokolow who I quoted initially about these technological changes. They're just focusing on technological fixes. There are other types of changes that we can make too, for instance, population control. So these are only focused on the technologies, but people can discuss, and I'm sure they will, other types of measures beyond these technological changes. And to do that, I have a visual aid, which I'll bring down. You don't need to see a lot of detail here. And a handout was on your seat, so this will relate to the handout that is there. So this is a graph. Along the bottom here is the year. We have a year 2005 and the year 2055. And if we look at this axis is the level of carbon emissions worldwide, and currently we're at roughly 7 billion tons of carbon emissions every year. And if you kind of assume, and it's plausible, that with business as usual, we'd move up to something on the order of 14 billion tons of carbon emissions by the year 2055, this 50-year period. Now what Pakala and Sokolow have done is posit that we have the technologies, we have the capability of offsetting this increase, and they come up with activities or projects which each will offset a billion tons of carbon emissions. So they call each of these billion-ton projects one wedge. They call them a stabilization wedge. Now, this will, you know, getting us down, that will only stabilize our emissions to the atmosphere at the world level. We'd actually need some wedges below that to get us down to what we think is actually going to be the needed target to stabilize, to get at something like 450 parts per million of CO2. So, but their exercise was to show us how we could at least stabilize. And to do that, we need seven of these wedges, seven of these projects that would offset a billion tons of carbon by the year 2055. And that's what's in the handout on one side, and I'll talk about that briefly. So if you look at the side that says stabilization wedges, actions that would each offset 1 billion tons of carbon. And we'll talk about a few of these. They're broken down into different sections. Increased efficiency and conservation, carbon capture and storage, fuel switching, nuclear energy, and renewable energy and biostorage. So let's look first at the increased efficiency and conservation. We could get 1 billion tons offset if all the cars expected to be on the road in 2055 got 60 miles per gallon. We could get another billion tons, number two, if we cut the amount traveled by each vehicle by half by improving mass transit worldwide. We get another billion tons by decreasing the emissions associated with all new buildings and all current buildings. That includes heating, cooling, water heating, and so on. We get another billion tons by increasing the efficiency of electric power production from 40% to 60%. I think current coal plants get on the order of 40%. Newer combined cycle coal plants will get 60%, but there's a big problem with coal. And that the attempt there is to sequester carbon. If there are going to be more coal plants being built, there's a possibility of capturing the carbon, and that's this entire category here, taking carbon dioxide and putting it in the ground. I've heard that being suggested more often than putting it in the ocean. There are geologic formations that people think plausibly could be filled with carbon dioxide, although that has not been demonstrated yet. Nuclear power is self-explanatory. We'd have to triple the current nuclear power capacity in the world to get another billion tons carbon offset. Renewable energy and biostorage, 2 million windmills worth of electric power, that's another billion tons of carbon. Solar arrays, we'd need solar arrays covering about 2 million hectares, about the size of New Jersey. That would give us another billion tons. Use of wind power to make hydrogen, taking water and splitting it into hydrogen and oxygen. If we had 4 million windmills and we made hydrogen from it, that would give us a billion tons of carbon offset. Notice we need twice as many windmills to make hydrogen and get that the billion ton offset as we do if we make electricity from wind power. So wind power is more efficient in terms of making electricity and offsetting carbon. Sustainably produce about 30 times more biofuels than we do today. There's a lot of news recently about the problems in using corn ethanol. It's not only raising fuel prices, but there's the thought that it's causing more tillage around the world, and that is that tillage is emitting carbon. So on net, we're actually emitting more carbon with putting corn into ethanol than we're saving. But there are thoughts about how we can get biomass without causing that extra tillage effect. So that's the challenge there, to get biomass sources that don't cause extra tillage and emission of carbon dioxide. Halting global deforestation, that's another billion tons. Planting trees on an area the size of the contiguous United States, that's another billion tons. Huge projects. And these types of things are only going to be, we're only going to have the incentive to do this if there's a cap and trade mechanism that forces people to have to buy carbon credits. So that's, as we pause for cell phone, okay. Now I'll shift one more time. That's the global level picture about how aggressively we have to act and some of the technologies that could, if there is eventually is a global cap and trade system that could be could come and help us save as much carbon emissions as we will need. Now I'll shift entirely in another direction. There was another speaker at this conference on climate change. He was a sociologist from Michigan State, and he said one of the things we have to pay attention to is human behavior and how it is that we're going to engender individuals to change their behavior to save carbon emissions. His name was Thomas Dietz, and on the other side of your handout are findings of a study that he cited that have some simple, high-impact actions that individuals can do. And we can get in high impact even if we don't get 100% participation in these. And I'll read the seven of many more opportunities. So these are the seven that he cites from previous studies, and then he gives the impact a little further down the page. Reduce engine idling. So if you go to the ATM and you're there getting money, it's a drive-up ATM, turn off your engine. Don't let your engine run. Or if you're waiting for somebody at their house to pick somebody up, turn off your engine if they're going to be a minute or two to come out of the house. So engine idling is one. Reduce standby power in your house. Everything that has a phantom load being drawn on it, televisions, VCRs, computers on a power strip. and turn off the power strip when you're not using the equipment. Faster adoption of compact fluorescent lights. If you don't use them everywhere you can, put them in. Adjust temperature setting by 2 degrees. 2 degrees cooler for heating and 2 degrees warmer for cooling. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay. But of course, if you're already down at low temperature, don't, please. I expect a lot of you are. Don't overdo it. Lower water heater temperatures. I've heard as a target to have your water heater set at 120 degrees. Higher than that is probably not needed. Maintain tire pressures. If you don't have, if your pressure in your tires is too low, it's more resistance. You use more gasoline. Most cars, I think it's 32 pounds per square inch. And replace vehicle air filters more frequently. If you have a lot of dust clogging those, it also reduces your car efficiency. Now, in the handout I'm showing you there, he makes a calculation showing that if even people, you know, there's half or less of the people adopt these measures, we can still get a lot of emissions saved in the United States. In fact, he asserts that if the percentages he showed, the percentage adoptions he shows there were attained, we could get 25% of the target that Lieberman-Warner Act calls for by the year 2050. That's my understanding of what they're saying here. So these collectively can have a huge impact. They seem like small things, but collectively, if large numbers of people did them. So this is an example of kind of the, as I've heard say, low-hanging fruit that we ought to be doing. We ought to be changing our behavior because it really can have a substantial impact. So shifting one more time, what can Prairie as a community do to address climate change? And the answer, become a UU Green Sanctuary. The Green Sanctuary program includes, but is not limited to, efforts to reduce carbon emissions. There are many different, the Green Sanctuary program asks that congregations look at their impact and their relationship to the environment in many dimensions. Our water use, our recycling, our purchasing practices, do we buy green materials? How do we take care of our grounds? Do we use, what kind of chemicals do we use? How are we engaged in the community on issues related to the environment? Species extinction, the whole range of environmental issues. So by bringing up Green Sanctuary in the context of climate change, and I'll tend to focus on that, it really has a much broader set of issues. But I'm going to tend to focus on the climate change part of it. But when we do engage in it, we'll be talking about all of these issues. So the objectives of the Green Sanctuary program are first, to build societal awareness of environmental issues. Second, to generate commitment for lifestyle changes, meaning members and then other people we would reach out to. Motivate UUs to community action on environmental issues. Build a connection between spiritual practice and environmental consciousness. And build awareness of and rectify environmental injustices. Now, the program does this by asking a congregation to identify 12 different projects or activities that they'd carry out over a period of a year or two, depending upon how energized and aggressive they want to be. And there are four areas for these activities: sustainable living, environmental justice, religious education, and worship and celebration. One of the first things you do to get launched in the Green Sanctuary program is to do two different kinds of audits. One is of the congregation's activities, meaning how are we doing in terms of heating this building, recycling, using green products, landscaping, so on. How do we do kind of in our congregational level activities? That's one kind of assessment. The other assessment is a personal assessment. How are we individually engaged in environmental practices? So you do those two surveys, and that's kind of a baseline, kind of where are we currently? And then based on that, we look at places where we could be improving, we could be changing, things we want to focus on. And there's some examples that I found of what congregations have done. And here's where I'll focus on the climate change part of things. There was a really long list of particularly climate change actions that congregations had completed. Here's, I'll read you some of the lists that I found. Commit a line item in the church budget to support wind power. In this case, it was in New Mexico through the Blue Sky Project. Calculate the congregational carbon footprint, or maybe this is more broadly. There's other kinds of footprint beside carbon. And commit to making the congregation carbon neutral. Lead field trips to sites such as energy neutral houses, passive solar and solar electric houses. Create a community investment program with microloans for insulation upgrades. Make the annual auction green themed. Install timed thermostats. Have the youth conduct a survey. How did you get to church today? Calculate personal carbon footprints and commit to reducing emissions, and in some cases offsetting the portion you could not reduce by buying offsets through the carbon fund. And it turns out the UUA has a partnership with the carbon fund and the carbon fund is an organization that makes investments that reduce carbon. Sell compact fluorescent lights as a fundraiser with the youth group. Support state legislation on renewable energy and energy conservation. Organize letter writing events to support legislation to end mountaintop removal, coal mining. Protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge against oil drilling. Establish a cap and trade system to reduce carbon emissions. And so on, and many more. I have some more, but there are many more on their website. So these are ways that we could personally become involved, and I guess I gave a personally, I guess, and also on a congregational level. Now, I'll conclude in a moment. Before that, I'll give the main messages from the talk that John Holdren gave. John Holdren's remarks were the very first ones I gave about us now being in the prospect that we have to work to avoid catastrophic climate interference. And these are the summary of his main points from his talk. Global warming is a misnomer. We should be calling it global climatic disruption. The disruption and its impacts are now growing more rapidly than was expected just a few years ago. The world is already experiencing dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system. The question is now, to motivate reaching higher on the tree, this tree, I guess it contains fruit, as well as research and development to bring more fruit into reach. The United States must switch from being a laggard to a leader, and sooner rather than later, if the world is to act in time. So with that, I'll open up to any comments and discussion.
I want to thank you so much for doing this, Ken. And I want to just tie a little bit of this, the UUA initiative, back to its prairie roots. The UUA resolution for the Green Congregation came about from the initiative of the UU Society in Oxford, Ohio, and it was Ori Laux, a past member of Prairie, who provided the impetus with their group. And Ori and Eleanor were members here in the 70s, maybe early 80s, 70s. And Ori was on the staff at the Environmental Institute here at the university, and has been a leader in the Unitarian movement. And we co-sponsored the resolution when it was taken to General Assembly as a congregation. So it comes around.
I remember when Ori was here and he discussed it with us prior to its being submitted. Yeah.
Well, if you take the New York Times, or you can get it there, this is their green issue in the New York Times magazine, and they've got some of these things that Ken mentioned. And some of the categories are act, eat, invent, learn, live, move, and build. So those are some of the things. And I wanted to say it's pretty discouraging to hear the goals and how, you know, so many billion tons have to be done and how we have so far to go. But also in here there's an article about, you know, what Ken said, you know, you start with the things you can do, the low-hanging fruit. So, you know, have a garden, do this and that. Don't idle your car at the timeout place.
One of the things that I found really interesting that United Parcel Service did that was kind of near and dear to my heart is they've decided to do their route planning so that they minimize the number of left turns they have to make, because the more left turns you have to make, the more time you often have to spend sitting there idling and waiting to make a left turn. And that just by doing that, that they discovered that they were able to reduce their fuel costs, which was an economic benefit to them as well as being an environmental benefit. And one of the other things I've discovered as a meeting planner, that hotels are starting to get into this, and that doing things like not turning on the heat in the room before a guest gets there and leaving the lights off makes a huge difference in their electric bills. And so they're saying, hey, this makes economic sense for us, so now we're going to start doing it more.
About the hotel things, they also now, some of them also now, tell you not to put the towels on the floor if you don't want to change them every day. I mean, we don't change our towels every day at home. But I have a question, or a couple of questions to you. Of course, you know, I agree with everything you say, but there are some downsides that need to be discussed or addressed so that the people won't focus on them too much. What about what I've been reading in the paper recently, this intense noise pollution of windmills? There was a big case in Kansas, I think, where there were two brothers and they're suing each other, or one is suing the other, and it turns out when the windmills are fairly close to the living quarters of people, the incessant and unstopped noise really drives people nuts. It would drive me nuts too. And can that somehow be alleviated, or, you know, what kind of things have to be done to convince the public that this is one of the things you have to deal with? The other thing is, while Europe in many ways is ahead of the United States in grassroots green things, many of the European countries, of course, reject nuclear power. And those are two tricky issues. I wonder if you could say something about them.
I don't know the res. I know there is the controversy concerning the sound and other undesirable things concerning wind power. I know there's a discussion in Wisconsin. I know Judy attended a hearing on that topic. And I don't know the resolution. I don't know the degree of difficulties nor how it will be resolved. So on that one, and your second one was concerning nuclear. Well, I know France, I think France has 80% of its power from nuclear. So there are some countries, and Sweden and Finland, and other, I think Scandinavian countries are phasing out of nuclear power. So it varies by country. And there's also discussion of eventually having reactors that are both much safer and produce much less radioactive or harmful radioactive materials. So there are a lot of things in play there, and I simply don't know how that's going to all be resolved.
There are two major processes, factors that are driving this increase of carbon dioxide emission into the atmosphere. One of them is increasing activity per person around the world. There are more and more cars every year, more bigger and bigger houses, etc. And the second one is increasing population. You have to realize that the world population is still exploding. huge increases. And every person that's born into this, that is every additional person on this earth, increases the amount of carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And so one of those wedges we were talking about has to be reducing population. Actually, should be the total number of people on the earth should be much less than it is today. I don't know if you heard, I heard on the radio the other day, PBS had an hour-long program. I only heard the first statement. The statement was with something like 6.1 billion people now. If everybody in the earth, on the earth now, had the same standard of living, I think this was the quote, that the Americans do, the average American, and the same carbon, the same impact, ecological footprint, let's say, we would need, I think the figure was 5.3 Earths to support.
I heard a talk recently by a physician for Physicians for Social Responsibility, and she said that if our she had a projection of 9 billion people, I think, by the year 2050 or so. If we were to avoid a billion of those people somehow, that would be one wedge, one billion tons carbon offset.
It looks, it seems to me that one of the results of global warming is our water issues, and which also has a lot of hanging fruit that you can work on. And I was wondering if your group works with all these other groups that are working on how we're supposed to help the fact that our water is shrinking and all the problems that go along with that, like bottled water and the things that people are doing as far as privatizing water and the fact that people have to move away from areas and the Great Lakes. You mean all those water issues, is that being discussed or fit into anything?
Well,
I hear that
primarily as a consequence of global warming and a harm that we need to work to avoid, as opposed to a cause of global warming. It's a consequence, and certainly there are great problems in that regard. But maybe there are others here that know more about that than I do. How about Ann? Ann's been having.
We have a lot of other questions, but our time now, we have five more minutes.
So everybody gets 30 seconds.
30 seconds, all right, make it short.
Quickly on car idling, hybrids turn off their engine when you're at a stop, so that's a good thing for them. But Ken, could you give us an idea, and also it was a wonderful presentation, thanks so much for it. Could you give us an idea of what kind of international cooperation is happening? I mean, that seems to be the crux of achieving these goals, that we really have to work together as an international community on this. Can you give us a sense of how well or poorly that's advancing?
Well, what I know, I guess my last attempt to learn, I followed what happened in Bali last fall, I guess it was, November, and there was a fairly strong resolution to produce another climate change treaty in 2 years' time in Copenhagen, but there's a real timing problem. There's a great deal of support. The Europeans are just a great deal further ahead than we are. One of the things to come out of the Bali, just a few bullet points. There was a lot more attention paid to financial mechanisms. How is the developing world going to get money? How is the developed world going to get money to the developing world to facilitate changes? And what will be the relationships that will be forged there so that the developing world will be engaged? Level of commitment. The United States needs to act very quickly after the change of the new administration to get involved in that process, because it all happens. There are going to be several rounds of discussions leading up to the Copenhagen final meeting. The first one occurred this last week in Paris. So there is a window. There is a lot of tremendous effort being put on the, particularly the part of the Europeans, to forge a very aggressive, more aggressive than would be. I guess there's a subset of people that, subset of the scientists that put together the IPCC findings that think we need to be a bit more aggressive than the IPCC findings showed, because that was a consensus document that people were kind of, they took into account the people that were kind of the doubters. I mean, even the doubters are thinking we have a huge problem, but the doubters are saying, well, it isn't quite as huge as others are thinking it. So the Europeans are in the lead thinking that it is a very severe problem and we need to jump in and at least follow well, if not lead.
On the heels of that, the current administration has kind of chosen not to comply with some of the treaties, and you use the term we're legally bound by a treaty to follow those, and the executive branch right now really isn't on several different, they've been kind of a power grab, and that's kind of a concern. How do we go, you know, use our branch of government to, you know, get the people's voice and kind of get that shift back? I understand your point on the next administration, but this could be a problem that can happen. I think the precedent is set now, and it's kind of a concern that we wouldn't be able to hold them accountable to hold on to those treaties and really agree with them and comply with them.
A lot of politics. I won't.
Ken, I thank you for the talk. I've been trying to switch over to fluorescent bulbs, and I'm doing it with a little misgivings because I've read that they contain mercury, and I haven't had any burnout yet. But I'm wondering, what in the world are you going to do with a fluorescent bulb when it burns out? So far, we have no place to dump them. Yeah. Okay.
The amount of mercury in a compact fluorescent light bulb is way smaller than the amount of mercury that is emitted by the power plant to generate the electricity for your incandescent light bulb, and that mercury is spread over a far larger area. Stores that sell compact fluorescent light bulbs have to take them back. There is a website. If you go to Clean Sweep or the recycling website through the city, they will tell you where you can go to recycle your bulbs safely. Some of them will take them for free. Some of them will charge. Yeah. Yeah. Lots and lots of stores will take them. They recycle them.
Well, one or two more questions. I think we're... wrap up.
You'll take one or two more.
Well, two more. Okay. We have two hands up there.
We're now 15 seconds to
person. Okay. Oh, dear. I had a comment and a question, and I'll talk real fast. My comment has to do with attitudes that we implant in our children, not just in RE. I have never seen such an entitled generation in my life, and we tell our kids every day that it's all out there and they can have it and they should go for it. We really maybe have to modify that a little bit. My question is a political one, and it has to do with McCain. Supposing that Hillary and Barack can't get it together and we hand that election to McCain, how much do you personally feel, from what you've done in your committee work, that we can count on his commitment to the environment when he's pressured, as he will be, despite Congress's best wishes, by corporate interests? He seems to get along
industry,
quite well with them.
Industry is very aggressive supporting these measures.
I would say that's the understatement of the eons.
No, at this conference I went to, the CEO of Duke Power, Duke Energy, which is one of the largest coal power generating companies in the United States, was there saying he's fully in support of dramatic measures.
I think that when you look at these huge numbers, and you look at the first page, it kind of tells you the futility of the second page. The fact that I'm going to lower my water heater temperature by 2 degrees is not going to make any difference at all, really. In fact,
point
now,
is that if we all do it, it will make a difference.
Well, it may not, because in my house, propane gas now has become more expensive than electricity, and it's cheaper to heat your house with electrical than it is with propane. So you maybe could just take all the insulation off your hot water heater and put it in the house. Seriously, these things change. I mean, it's not one thing. But the fact of the matter is, if we are smug in thinking that by doing these things we're changing something, we're not. We have to get out and push the politicians to make some tremendous changes, because it's a huge problem.
Right. There's no silver bullet.
Yeah. Silver buckshot. Okay. Thank you, Ken. That was really. This was very stimulating, and the discussion can go on after the service. Ken will be around to carry on the conversation. I'm sure it's not going to end with his comments. So right now, however, we do have to attend to other items in our service, and one of the important parts of a congregation is to tend to the financial needs of the congregation, and we do that by offering you to participate in our offering as we pass offering baskets. Thank you, Delita. Beautiful. Now it's time for us to welcome guests and visitors. If you're here for the first time or second or haven't attended for a while, we invite you to introduce yourself and say perhaps something about yourself and what brought you here.
You all know I'm here.
Thanks for re-welcoming me so warmly. It's really sweet. I'll give you an update on the family. Erin is in her writing phase of her PhD program at Indiana University in Literature. Alana is working once again for the Smithsonian Folklife Festival in D.C., having just a great time. And Ack is on sabbatical for a year in D.C., and I'm with him there telecommuting to my job, and I had to come back to run a panel on Friday at the Arts Board, so that's why I'm here, and I'll go back on Tuesday.
Great.
So it's just great seeing y'all.
Good to see you.
Glad you're here. Okay. Please take a moment now to read the announcements in the order of service, and we could perhaps take any other announcements that are not listed. We don't have that. Dave, you have an announcement you want to?
I've got a leftover Christmas tree, a living Christmas tree, sitting outside my house in a pot. And it's about 3 feet tall. It's a spruce or a fir. And the pot is about 2 feet. And if somebody wants it, just come and take it. Otherwise, I'm going to put it out on the curb. And it's 305 South Siegel Road. It's the yellow house with the big solar panels on it. And just, if I'm not there, just take it.
305 South Siegel. Okay. All right. Let us now close our service on Earth Day Sunday with hymn number 303. We are the earth, upright and proud. If you would like to stand as you are able, let us join our hearts together singing.
Given our human capacity to reflect and act upon our own lives, as well as the condition of the world, we accept with humility and determination our responsibility to remedy and mitigate global warming, climate change, through innovation, cooperation, and self-discipline. May we accept the challenge to undertake this work for the preservation of life on Earth.